inform all parties that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Go ahead, ma'am. You may now begin.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. This is the Internationalized Registration Data Working Group call, and today is the 24th of May. On the call we have today Rafiq Damik, Jim Galvin, Bob Hutchinson, Avery Doria, and Owen Smigelski. And welcome, Owen. I just saw that you just joined.
Hello.
And from staff, we have Steve Shang and Julie Hedlund. Oh, and I see that Ram Mohan has just joined us as well. Welcome, Ram.
Hi, welcome. I had dialed into the 800 number, and they told me it was the wrong number. They gave me a new number to dial in.
Yeah, they just changed the numbers. Gisela sent around a notice to the list on Friday, I think it was, that we had new numbers, and I apologize for the confusion.
Ah, you're right. My mistake. I missed the new number.
Right.
I see the note now that you mention it.
I wasn't paying attention, and then I thought, oh, I better check that number, and it is different. So, but glad you were able to get on. So Ram, I just did a roll call. We have yourself, Owen Smigelski, Avery Doria, Bob Hutchinson, Jim Galvin, and Rafiq Damik, and myself and Steve Shang. And I know that Edmund Chung cannot join us. I don't hear Jeremy on the call, but I think we should go ahead and get started. And maybe what I will do is just let you all know that we're planning on having a sort of, I hesitate to call it a public forum per se, but a public session in Brussels. I've set aside, tentatively put, made a request to put a session on the schedule for a Thursday morning, and on the 24th. And there will be both a chance to provide an update on the discussions we've been having here, and then also it's going to be a combined session with the Who Is Services Requirements Report as well. So we'll have kind of a double session that'll go for, I think, an hour and a half. So we'll, you know, as we meet now, what we'll do is staff will prepare some draft ideas based on our discussions for some slides for that session, and have the working group review those and give suggestions. So we can, I think we'll get going on that pretty soon here, and get that around so we have plenty of time to get the slides posted on the schedule prior to that session. Oh, I see Jeremy has joined us. Jeremy, welcome.
Hey, Julie. How's it going?
Good, good. Well, wonderful. Glad you could join. I don't know how much of that you caught, but I'm just saying that we have tentatively put on the schedule an opportunity for a public discussion in Brussels for that Thursday morning. And Jeremy, just so you know, on the call, in addition to yourself, we have Jim Galvin, Ram Mohan, Owen Smigelski, Avery Doria, Bob Hutchinson, and Rafiq Damik.
Hello, everyone.
So I was wondering, if you like, Jeremy, perhaps we could pick up where we left off, and there's been some discussion on the list as well, as far as talking about the idea behind sort of a fourth model, and in particular, perhaps doing kind of building in a kind of backwards compatibility, and I know Jim had provided some helpful information on that on the list, and I was wondering if it's okay with you, Jeremy, if I could ask Steve Shang to summarize that discussion or help get us started.
That'd be great. Yeah, there's a great amount of discussion, so thanks everyone who participated for adding the comments and hearing that fourth option question. That'd be great. Steve, you want to go through that?
Great, thanks so much, Jeremy. Steve, go ahead.
Sure. So the fourth model that we are talking about is allow internationalized registration data in who is. We do not put any limit, but for backward compatibility for port 43, you know, place a requirement for that. So this is really a requirement. That's, you know, for port 43, there still needs to be a kind of ASCII output of the Whois data. There are a couple of ways that we can do that. The first way is registrars can still prefer to transliterate or translate, if they will, of the IRD information into US ASCII. And another way is Jim has suggested using some kind of a signal like the MIME data format. Jim, I was wondering if you could talk more about that.
Well, sure. I mean, I think the critical thing here, when I look at SMTP and I think about its transition from 7-bit ASCII to 8-bit, SMTP has an advantage over Whois, and that there is actually a convenient place for a signaling mechanism. If you know the SMTP protocol, you know, it opens when you open the connection, you say hello and say your name, and hello is H-E-L-O, and that's the first thing you send. What they did to add 8-bit and then, of course, all kinds of other options and extensions since that time was to change the opening signal to be E-hello, E-H-L-O. For extended hello, still four characters, but they put the E in front. This had the advantage that anything that was not upgraded would simply reject and say, I don't know what you're talking about, and then you would have to repeat the command with a hello, or perhaps return the message because it couldn't be downgraded and those kinds of things. What I was talking to Steve Sheng about was in port 43, we could do something like change the, instead of normally what you do with the port 43 is you just send to it a domain name, which presumably comes at it in US ASCII with a carriage return line feed at the end. And I was suggesting that you could simply proceed if you wanted an extended response and extended features. I just casually proposed that the magic keyword in the beginning could be the word extend. Might be the first thing that you send with a space, and you still follow it with the domain name. And then, in fact, you could, if you're going to do it, you could have another space and a whole bunch of other options, just like the SMTP does. And that's what you put all there at the end. And what happens from a backwards compatibility point of view is presumably extend or whatever magic sequence you put there. You'd simply get back, you know, a response that says it doesn't exist. But you would have to, as a client, which is extended, would have to recognize that as meaning, oh, they're not going to provide me extended responses. And so you would send your request again with just the domain name in it. You might also be smart enough to not try an extend query if the domain name doesn't have one. So obviously you would only issue an extend query if you had an IDN domain name, for example. But if it understood the extend and then it took the domain name, what you would then return is, and there are a lot of things we could do at this point, I just suggested you could go the path that HTTP does, which you now return a MIME-based content type. So you have a content type, you then have in MIME a designation of a type and everything, a blank line, and now you've got extended output of whatever you want to say, whatever we want to define in this. You know, I think that that allows the option of Whois in a backwards compatible way returning non-ASCII output to something which is willing to accept it. So that's my quick 3-minute introduction.
Yeah, this is Julie. That is extremely helpful, I think. And I'm wondering if maybe we could open it up for questions, particularly those who may not have had the opportunity to be on the last call. And I should have mentioned before that this discussion arose when we were discussing the last call about whether or not we wanted to require transliteration and some of the concerns that there isn't a universal format for transliteration and you know, how useful it might actually be and what really is the purpose and the output of you know, the purpose of doing that. And Edmund had asked about possibility, I think, of backwards compatibility, and that's kind of where this discussion got started. So I'd like to, Steve, is there anything that you would like to add to this explanation or other comments that you came through concerning this issue on the list before we open this up for discussion?
There are some other discussions on the list. But it's mostly value, the value of transliteration, which is may or not probably not relevant for discussion of Model 4. So I don't have anything to add. Sorry.
Right. So I think that there were a lot of questions about the value of transliteration, whether or not that would be a necessary requirement. But it sounds like there is some interest in looking at having some backwards compatibility. So at this point, I'd like to open it up for discussion and questions. What do people think about this possibility?
Julie, I have a question.
Please go ahead, Jim.
So when Steve was talking about comments on the list, there was one question on the list that I actually thought was interesting, which really did not get a lot of discussion, and I think it does relate to this topic. There's a question of what is the user of who is? I mean, what is the reason that the service exists? Even we have here in our discussions been talking about a variety of use cases for who is data. And I think that affects this discussion. I mean, if you're doing it for law enforcement, you have one set of requirements. If you're doing it just for the general public, you have a different set of requirements. Both cases have different privacy requirements, and both cases have different access control rules that might apply for different elements. I think that's an important consideration in whether or not transliteration or translation are valuable, or even this brainstorming idea that I'm tossing out here for how to provide extended services.
Is Julie. Jim, thank you. That's let's get back to that question then and maybe flesh that out a little bit further here. I'm not as familiar, I've used Whois myself, but I'm not that familiar. I'd kind of like to get a sense of, you know, perhaps we can, you know, there are obviously different uses for it, different people using it. Can we perhaps categorize a few of those? And I guess, you know, for the purpose of discussion, do we want to have different requirements depending on different users, or have something that's sort of a lowest common denominator, you know, that, you know, is sort of across all users? And I'm just throwing these questions out for discussion. So I welcome all of you to speak up and help us as staff see if we can coalesce around this idea. I'll ask our chair first. Jeremy, do you have any thoughts on this?
Oh, this is Jeremy. I was just about to frame the question a different way, so that way I wouldn't have to...
Oh, good. Please go ahead, Jeremy.
We've talked about in a few calls about the use, and I think we've enumerated law enforcement. We've enumerated IP concern or IP design, or just basically a way to communicate with someone. My understanding has been a technical continuity contact for the operations of the name. I think that I don't remember if it was on the same message, but there was certainly the kind of a noting that there hasn't ever been a systematic document, position paper, or some sort of institutionalization of what collectively we think Whois is for, and probably because there's been some, you know, different controversy that's associated with it. Kind of just as a point of order, I think we have to be careful about what we think of as Whois in terms of its use, but at the same time, it's kind of central to deciding the issues related with internationalized characters. So that said, that's kind of my piece in the sense of users. I don't see a lot of times where people are looking from one language set to another language set. So I do share the kind of the questioning of the value of translation or transliteration between two different language sets or script sets that are really unrelated. But that said, those applications do come up.
Hi, this is Avery. If I can add something.
Avery, this is Julie. Please go ahead.
Yeah. I think another type of user that certainly has talked to me and also has come up in our stakeholder group are consumers of various sorts. I anecdotally have known of many consumers who use Whois when they're checking out something new, some purchase, some whatever. So regular people do use it in that respect. And while I'm probably not qualified to go into the depths of the usage, I think there are concerns within philanthropic organizations where, they're asking people to give them buckets of money to do stuff. And sometimes those people, consumers not the right word for them in that respect, but the donors, donor community, might also use these. Now, to what extent people will be going off to non-local language, to do something, to donate, or to check on consumer, I don't know. But, given the translations that I now get all the time on all the Google pages I use, I can quite quickly, because, as soon as I bring up a page in Chrome, it offers to translate for me. And, it works really well. So given that, I could see myself, as one example, and anything I do, other people do, going to multiple sites that are outside my normal language and getting that information. Now, if we could trust Google to do the translation for us, it doesn't end up perhaps that big a deal. But the international use of the net, especially because of these translation services, will expand. I'm reading websites now in all sorts of languages I don't know. Thanks.
This is Julie. Thank you very much, Avery, and I'm glad you pointed that out. That is precisely the way I have used Whois, and not being a particularly technical person, but to just sort of check on who owns what and who's running what, and I've found it to be useful. I don't necessarily have the expectation of needing to have the information translated for me, and I would likely use one of those online tools. But I think that we shouldn't lose sight of the consumer and the international consumers as being one of the key groups using the Whois. Other thoughts from those on the call?
Yes. Hi, Julie. This is Owen. Just kind of following along with that, obviously, in addition to, there's more than just, I think, intellectual property concerns that could use this. I know certainly businesses use it for research purposes, to determining who owns something, where they located, what's going on. I can certainly think that the press and reporters might want this information. A lot of time, if you go to a website and the contact information might be old or there might not be a form, you'd be able to get a phone number or an email address off of the Whois. And I know when I was in college, I used Whois to contact people, even from abroad, because I was looking at their website, and I didn't want to use a web form. I wanted to contact them directly, so I would use that information for that. This is just stuff I came up with off the top of my head. I imagine if people were to put their minds to it, there's probably hundreds of uses that people use Whois for.
Hello, this is Steve. Can I add something? So in 2000, just some background, in 2006, there's a GNSO working group that discussed the purpose of Whois. There are two formulations for the for the purpose of who is. So the first formulation is the purpose of the GTLD who is service is to provide information sufficient to contact a responsible party for a particular GTLD domain name who can resolve or reliably pass on data to a party who can resolve issues relating to the configuration of the records associated with the domain name within the DNS server. So this is more, this formulation is mostly supported by registrar registry and the NCUC on this. There's another formulation called Formulation 2, which is supported by IPC, ISP, and the commercial and business user. Is the first part is essentially the same, but the second part is basically the purpose of the GTLD WHOIS service is to provide information sufficient to contact a responsible party for a particular domain who can resolve or reliably pass the data to a party who can resolve technical, legal, or other issues related to the registration use of the domain name. So the difference here, the first formulation is really the technical, you know, technical records and the configuration of the DNS server. And the second one is kind of more broad to resolve technical, legal, and other issues related to the registration or use of a domain name. I don't think there, you know, these two formulations exist. I'm not aware there's a final agreement on which of the two that we have. But I think for the purpose of this working group, we should take this as whatever is given to us, that we should take both definition A, formulation 1 and formulation 2, taken as given. So whatever we do, we need to support both. That's what I'm currently thinking.
Hi, this is Aubrey. Can I comment?
Go ahead, Rory.
Hi. I think in one sense, of course, you're right. And you're right. There was no decision. One of those was one vote higher than the other, and
right.
I believe I was the one vote that was higher on one of them than the other. but be that as may, that pertains mostly to the purpose of WHOIS from a policy perspective,
mm-hmm.
and concerns what policy things should be allowed and disallowed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that discussion is necessarily what should be technically possible, and so I'm not sure that should necessarily limit. When this group is looking mostly at what is technically reasonable versus what is a policy mandate. So in some ways I may be speaking out of both sides of my mouth, because from a policy perspective, when talking about individuals, I will take the tightest constraints you can find on what can be done with WHOIS. But if I'm talking about what's technically possible on a WHOIS against businesses, then, you know, I have a very different, especially from a consumer perspective, different perspective. So I you're right to bring those up. I think we have to satisfy both of those, but I don't think that necessarily even that should be a limitation for what is technically possible. And policy can also change country by country. So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Steve. That was helpful background, and thank you, Aubrey, also for the clarification. So we have several different possible users of the WHOIS: consumers, law enforcement, intellectual property, and others we probably haven't thought of. And I ask if there are others that we should add to that, or if that's even necessary. But do we, we have a couple of possible policy definitions for the purpose of WHOIS that shouldn't necessarily constrain what we think might be technically possible or reasonable requirement. And I'm certainly, I encourage you to suggest other possible uses, and then I would ask, too, if perhaps we could discuss if there are sort of various, you know, it's a varied audience or use of the Who Is, then do we try to reach all of these groups equally, or do we have, I mean, it's obviously it's complicated if we have, you know, different requirements for different groups, but then we might have consumer users who are happy to just go out and you know, use a Google tool to translate something, but we might have law enforcement who might have a very urgent need to get information or may need something faster or something more complete. So anyway, just some thoughts. I welcome those of you on the call to get, help with this discussion.
So I have a comment. This is Jim.
Please go ahead, Jim.
So I asked the question primarily because it was put out on the mailing list, and I don't see that it even is included in some of our early response document. And I was, let's see, sorry, give me a moment to collect my thoughts here. The question, what really is going on in my mind, the way that I would answer the question is, it's not clear to me that we should even be asking the question. It's interesting that we have a lot of use cases, but I think we knew that going in. And so, you know, I thought that the charter of this group was really focused on display requirements and what it would take to change, you know, existing implementations or infrastructure, if you will, in order to support something besides US ASCII. When I saw the Who Is, you know, like who is the user of Who Is, it occurred to me that that sort of partially answered the question of the value or importance of transliteration and translation, because that's one of the questions that we're asking ourselves. When I listened to Avri talk about how, you know, in her particular browser, she can go to websites and, you know, if it's in a different language, she's got a translate button right there and can just translate things. I'm wondering if something like that isn't also the right solution for Who Is. We don't really need to concern ourselves with the user or, you know, the consumption of the data. It's about making the right data available or the best data that we can available. And, you know, if there are services or the ability for people to do what they need in order to see the data, and listening to Avri talk about how websites are handled, seems to me that we don't really have to answer that question, and, you know, we don't need to concern ourselves with translation and transliteration. So I just put that out there to see what people think.
Thank you, Jim. This is Julie. That's quite helpful. What do others think?
Question from Avri.
Go ahead, Avri.
Okay, thanks. Now, I have that working in Chrome, and it's nice, but are we assuming that, therefore, everyone would need to rely on Chrome and Google's Translate service, which, okay, I rely on, but for their Who Is needs? I mean, you know, one could hope that this does become as ubiquitous as Babelfish someday in the future, but I mean real Babelfish, not the company. But you know, at the moment it isn't. So I don't know if we could sort of say, well, Google has solved it, so let's not worry. Thanks.
Thank you, Avri. Others?
Well, I'll respond if you like.
Please go ahead, Jim.
I guess I'm not suggesting that we would say something like, you know, Google has solved the problem. I think I more generally was coming at this from the idea that people who, I guess the question is, in the user communities that we talked about, is there an international user? And are we, I mean, should a requirement on providing non-ASCII characters be that we have to accommodate all of those international users. And what I mean by that is it occurs to me that who is, in many ways, is a regional kind of thing, right? I mean, I'm going to be looking around for things. I suppose there is a user community that's going to want to know about things in another country, looking at websites, want to check out domain names from a whole completely different area, and maybe they will suddenly get things that they can't read or can't see, but presumably they're already getting that from the website they're dealing with then, too. I mean, I don't know. I'm just sort of tossing things out here. I'm suggesting that the translation and transliteration issue, you know, the onus really is on the user that wants that data, because the people who are going to use the Whois data are going to be mostly regional. They're going to be able to deal with the fact that it's in a different language. That's my comment.
Thank you, Jim. Other comments?
This is Ram.
Ram, please go ahead.
Thank you. I guess my perspective is that, to some extent, aligned with where Jim is going, I think the goal of our working group is less about, you know, why should there be a Whois and what should be done with the Whois, and it's much more about how do we make sure that with the internationalization of registration data, that how do we ensure that there are appropriate standards and guidelines developed to accommodate the internationalization of data. And to me, I guess I'm still stuck on some fundamental things, like what is mandatory in terms of display and what is optional. If somebody provides, if a registrant provides solely internationalized data, is that okay? I'm not sure those issues have been laid to bed. And so I'm kind of a little confused as to why we're talking about who is the user, et cetera, because it seems like regardless of who the user is and whether the user is local or whether the user is international, some of the fundamental questions have to be laid to bed. What is the minimum required standard with internationalized data? What do we think is appropriate, and what is necessary, and what is sufficient? And I don't think I have the answers for that, or as a group, we have arrived at some sort of consensus for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ram. This is Julie. So those are excellent questions. Thank you very much. I think that probably we may have gotten a little sidetracked with discussion right now as far as who is the user, but we have talked quite a bit in these calls as far as how to treat the various elements of data, what standards might there be already existing, say for email or for telephone numbers, or you know, the various contact elements. And we had come down to trying to see if we could coalesce around a particular model. Steve had put forward three possible models and their approaches, as far as the contact information, and now we sort of tried to see if there was another model, maybe a fourth model, to move away from this idea of transliteration or translation and talk a little bit about whether or not we wanted to require backwards compatibility. But unless I'm wrong, I think you are quite right, Ram. We don't have a consensus yet. We are trying to see if we can pull together some agreement around a possible approach. I'm not sure that we necessarily are at that point. What I think Edmund had said on a previous call was that it would be good if we could have some discussion points, possibly an approach that we could have out there for discussion at a public session in Brussels to try to socialize some of these ideas a little bit further and get some more comment on them. Steve, could I ask you perhaps to summarize, and I don't know if it's easy to do here, but you know, we talked. There were a number of areas I think where there was some agreement early on with some of the sort of more straightforward elements, and then and then there's been the discussion of the three models. What is your sense as far as some of some of the conversation, early conversation that we had in this group, because it's probably worth reminding all of us, as far as where there did seem to be some agreement and some of the more kind of straightforward areas, like, say, email or telephone numbers, that sort of thing?
Sure, Julie. I think the working group, the discussion that we have, seems that the working group want to have a requirement that who is client must be able to accept a user query of domain name in UOA label format. So and they must be able to display that in both UNA label format. So I think it seems that that's kind of the requirement that we agree early on to do that. And then the second part is we kind of discuss about separating these data elements and see how do we internationalize them differently. And, we have agreement on domain names at both UNA label. We have agreement on sponsor and registrar that they remain in the U.S. ASCII. It seems that, email address and telephone and fax number, and those are, their existing standard. The one thing that we did not, we have yet to reach an agreement is on, is what do we do with the contact information, for example, the postal address, the name of the entity name, the name of the registrant. Should they be U.S. ASCII, or should they be internationalized? And that's why we discuss the three models. So as Ram suggested, we haven't, decided on what is required, what is necessary, and what is sufficient. But you want me to go through each of the models, or is that?
Steve, this is Julie. I don't think you need to go through each of the models necessarily. I thought actually though there was some discussion as far as the three models that there was some agreement around some of the
yes,
one of the models. I'm wondering if you could remind us, if you can, what that was.
Right. Of the three models that we discuss, model one require a must be present script in Whois, and with the option for registrars to provide localized data. So the requirement is still in U.S. ASCII Whois, but the option is registrars can put localized data. I think the working group thought that is kind of the bare minimum that we have, the lowest level, the lowest denominator that we have. The second model is really to registrants can provide the registration information in whatever script accepted by the registrar, and registrar provide a point of contact, if issues of translation arises or are requested. And I think the working group thought that that is workable too. And the last one is, we get hung up by the transliteration, is registrants provide their information in a local script that can, in any script that can be accepted by the registrar, and the registrars provide tools to assist the registrants in providing for transliteration. And then, publish that in a must-be-present language. So we still require must-be-present language. So the only difference between model 2 and 3 is who does the transliteration. So those are the three models that we discussed.
And so model 4 is...
So the model 4 is, you know, we don't say about, we do not require, you know, transliteration or translation. We simply require a backward compatibility for port 43 WHOIS. So the registrar, you know, basically setting a baseline, and the registrars can transliterate, they can translate, or as Jim said, they don't have to do any of these. They can use this extended format MIME to signal that.
Well, I'd like to suggest that we describe the Model 4 a little bit differently.
Okay.
I had imagined that it would mean that, you know, WHOIS could stay the way it is,
mm-hmm.
which simply means that, I guess it's a lot like Model 1. It's Model 1 in the sense that we have a must-be-present language.
Right.
So we'd probably continue with the U.S. ASCII model. So whatever is coming into the registrar, whatever they're doing, they have to do something to make a U.S. ASCII version of that in order to continue to support the backwards compatible WHOIS.
Right.
But I could also imagine that they might be encoding a lot of the data that's there in order to make it U.S. ASCII, which would make it essentially, you know, unreadable and non-usable to someone who doesn't know how to decode it, but then if they didn't know the language, they wouldn't be able to do anything with it anyway. And then, so it's changing Model 1 to simply add a piece that says, if I happen to be an extended client, I'm going to query and see if you're an extended WHOIS server, and if you are, then I'm going to get all kinds of good stuff, and I'm going to get it in the local language displayed for me. But presumably I'm able to handle that. That's why I'm making an extended query. So I guess it's a specific way of supporting the option. The question that I had with Model 1, although I agree with you, I think we seem to have consensus on that particular option, or at least more of a majority towards that model.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to optionally provide a local language? You know, I don't know what that is. I don't know how one gets that optional data. I guess we had at one time talked about in every field it might appear twice, once in U.S. ASCII and once in a bunch of, you know, whatever the script is. And that's interesting too, I suppose, but we never really talked about how you deal with that given that you have to maintain a U.S. ASCII presence in order to have backwards compatibility, which we don't even have today, right?
Right.
There are WHOIS servers out there today that are doing things that are, strictly speaking, a violation of the standard. So, anyway, I guess that's my comment.
Tom.
This is Ram.
Yeah, please go ahead, Ram.
I'm sorry, Jim. I'm not sure I understood the point you were driving to. What do you think we should do? I mean, I understand your observation, but where do you want to drive it?
Well, one way to look at this is that I guess I'm thinking that it's possible we're done, except for the question that you raised, which is, do we need to specify what's the minimum data that has to be offered? I'm suggesting here that, you know, the way forward is that we allow for people to simply enter in their local language, and we suggest that a mechanism be developed to query for that response in a local language. I mean, we seem to be focused a lot here on how to provide translation and transliteration or an optional way to provide the local language. I think...
What about port 43? What about its... What happens to that? This is Ram. What happens to that in your suggested model? Does it get deprecated over time, or does it just stay in place and escape characters get used? I guess I'm not sure what you're saying. You're suggesting we may be done, but If you declare that we're done, would we have solved the original goal of our working group?
Well, the goal was to speak to the issue of how to support non-US ASCII characters. And I think I'm going with Model 1, and I'm actually proposing a potential mechanism for what it means to allow the data to be, optional data to be provided in the local language. So I think the port 43 always stays around in the same way that, you know, SMTP has always stayed around. We've not moved off of, port 25 for SMTP. And eventually what happens is everybody migrates to the extended model, the servers and the clients.
This is Jeremy. What do...
Go ahead, Jeremy.
What do people think about the... I guess it's definitely a different, it's not really a model that it falls under. I guess it is, as Jim said, the first model, if anything, but it's basically a, do we say the client-side tools are robust enough to provide translation services or transliteration services or language interoperability?
I don't think I'm quite suggesting that. I think what I'm saying is that translation and or transliteration, I guess I'm not speaking to whether or not they're robust enough. I mean, I guess in our own conversations here, we're suggesting that there are tools that do appear to work for the most part. Maybe not all languages are supported. But I'm suggesting that we shouldn't put the onus for translation or transliteration on a registrar, on a registry, or on the registrant. It should be on the client that wants the data.
This is Aubrey. Can I come in with something?
Yeah, please go ahead, Aubrey.
Yeah, I'm not absolutely sure that I'm hearing correctly or understanding, so that's one of the reasons I want to speak. I think from the perspective, if I'm understanding correctly, of saying on a technical requirement at port 43 or whatever, what you're saying is that it should be able to support both the U.S. ASCII and optionally, and I'm not sure whether you're saying one or more other languages. As for a requirement of how you get that into another language at the user level, that is a different question. B, one, you're not recommending that the registrars be required to support, though that could indeed end up a policy issue. But And so it comes down to, from a technical perspective, the base level is it can support several languages. It doesn't convert between them. It takes what it's given. It stores it. It gives it back correctly. This is done by technical extensions and bits that say whether you're working in old mode or extended mode, et cetera. And that anything that's layered on top of that may be a requirement for registrars, may not, but it's not a requirement of the basic WHOIS system. Am I parsing it close to correctly?
Yes, with small or large, depending on your point of view, change. Really what I'm suggesting is making WHOIS 8-bit clean, not actually speaking to what languages it does or doesn't support.
Okay,
now, that's
so
a
that
technical answer, which I think
yeah,
you'll understand.
That would be your extended mode, and whether you were working in 8-bit clean or not.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. No, that doesn't... Yeah, that's fine.
The main point there is that languages really don't factor into the discussion. You know, I mean, I think that from ICANN's point of view, what we do is we say that we need a technical solution that allows WHOIS to be 8-bit clean, and that as a policy matter, we want to allow registrants and registrars to use their local language, and that's what should be able to be stored in the system, and so we need that technical solution, and, you know, push back on the IETF to come up with a technical solution.
This is Avery again. at the policy level, there would need to be a decision that said what the base everyone had to do. So there would be a policy decision that said everyone would still have to use U.S. ASCII or not, and even if they were using a local. And that's where you'd get into the other policy issues we've gotten into of translation, transliteration. But those would not be this group's problem, but they would be the next problem that sort of said technology has enabled you to store both. Now, from a policy perspective, you need to decide which you want to do and how.
So a bit of clarification. I think I'm not necessarily suggesting that both be stored. In the spirit of 8-bit clean, there's just one data set. You know, I mean, I'll pick on contact information just for purposes of example, but or even email address. I get to store my email address, and I can store my email address in whatever it is. I don't have to have a 7-bit clean version of it. If I've got an IDN email address, whether that's a local part or a domain part, the system's going to allow that to happen. And further, if I do a query, I can query with an IDN name right out of whois server, and that should work if it's 8-bit clean.
But, okay, and stop me if I'm asking too many questions, please. This is Avery again. So that means that one could have an application that did not also provide the 7-bit in your proposal.
Yeah, that's what I'm offering at the moment. I'm certainly open
right.
to be persuaded otherwise, but I'm thinking, right, just the system you have now, but 8-bit clean.
Okay, thanks. Now I understand what you're saying.
But, Jim, with 8-bit, we're talking about, what about Chinese and Japanese? There still be issues of transliteration, right?
Well, obviously, if you're going to make it 8-bit clean, you do have to indicate the character set in which something is encoded.
Right.
But, that would be part of the technical solution that would have to come in. I mean, the whois protocol is defined in the IETF, and so what they do is they turn it into, I'll invent something here. So you just make it an XML document, because then, by definition, you get all of the rest of the parameters you need so that you can deal with what you're getting. And the tricky part just becomes how you do the query in a backward-compatible way.
So I guess my question to the working group is that within the remit of this working group to discuss about the technical solution? Or the working group specify the requirement, and then somebody else does the technical work?
This is Ron. I think it's within the remit to say that it has to be done. I'm not sure we have all the right experts to actually provide the technical specifications. We should ask for the specifications to be developed if
okay.
we think that is the right thing to do.
Okay. Then the goal would be for us to agree on a model. Is that right?
This is Ron. Yes, I think so.
Yeah, Steve, this is Julie. So I think what would be helpful at this point, perhaps, is if we could simply enumerate, briefly, what are the elements, approaches that we think we have agreement on, including in particular, I think, this discussion, which I think has been extremely helpful, on what to do about the contact information. And so, in a way, we're not really, if we don't have several models, what we're really talking about is what are the requirements that we feel we can agree on across the board, and so you had gone through those and giving us a very helpful background. Now, I think it would be useful for you and I as staff to list, what we think would be agreed upon requirements and send those around, to the list and ask specifically for those in the group to comment on them and to say whether or not they agree with them to help us to see if we really are actually perhaps at a point where we can make a recommendation. And I should point out that this if we can say, well, you know, we are in general agreement on you know, this particular set of requirements, I think that before we put these down in a report format, I think we need to get a little more broader dialogue. I mean, this is a group with fairly good representation, but we really do want to make sure we're fully engaging the community, which is why if we could put these ideas out into a brief presentation and get community participation at Brussels and see if there are some things we haven't thought of. I think, as Edmund had pointed out in a previous call, that could be quite helpful to help us, you know, get to a stage of requirements. But I'm wondering what others think who are on this call. I mean, at the very least, as staff, we could write down what we think are agreed upon requirements and send those around. Would that be a good initial approach? Jeremy, what do you think?
Yeah, unless there's any further discussion, I mean, it sounds like we're kind of at a point of impasse of just trying to come to consensus around a particular issue, and certainly with the addition of a couple other topics and some discussion from staff would be useful, and also some discussion from the community would also be useful.
I think that the charter for this group, right, says that we're supposed to study the feasibility and suitability of introducing display specifications, right? I think that we have actually come to a number of potential consensus points here. We've sort of discussed to come around to a consensus about translation and transliteration, that it shouldn't be part of registry and registrar things. I think that's a point worth discussing and mentioning. We've agree, obviously, maybe it's a foregone conclusion or a premise in starting, but obviously we want to support local languages and let registrants use a local language. Registrars should be able to support a local language, and WHOIS data should be displayed in that local format. So whatever data is input by the registrant. And so then the third thing is that we are proposing that ICANN seek to have the WHOIS protocol itself as a technical specification be made to allow for registrants to use their local language. We'll have to find the right way to say that. I would say it as a technical person as making WHOIS 8-bit clean.
Jim, I thought if you agree on Model 1, the Model 1 require registrants provide a must-be-present language in WHOIS. So the registrant today would be, you know, inputting U.S. ASCII. So they wouldn't. They're required to input U.S. ASCII, although they have the option of providing local information. Right, so the local information is not a requirement, but an option.
Thank you, Steve. So do we want to require?
I certainly am at the point of saying I'm not in consensus with what you know, was just what Jim just listed as being what we had decided on. So, because I think the Model 1 does provide that must be included and the option. And also, I think that the issue of the registrar's requirements is not quite as absolute. It's that there's, you know, no technical requirement in WHOIS that forces the registrars that this group is placing on them, but that others may want to. And I don't think this group has the sort of charge with deciding what policy-wise needs to be done by registrars, just what the technology needs to support being done. So I'm not sure that I would agree with Jim's list of things we agree on.
So
the third one I do.
Yeah, Aubrey, if I can, just to try and make sure I understand, I think what you're saying is you believe that there needs to be a baseline language in which everything appears. So you like the fact that everything has to at least appear in U.S. ASCII. Would that be true?
Yes. In some version of ASCII, whether it could appear in extended ASCII or not may be an issue, but yes, that everything needs to appear in some form in ASCII, as well as the possibility of it appearing in a, I think the baseline for the technical, if we go back to the definitions that were read earlier, that the baseline of technically who do you reach, that in that technical community that is worldwide and is international, that some form of ASCII I'll say it, the lingua franca of communication, and that if that is still a requirement, a base level requirement for who is, then that has to be there. I think it's wonderful and should be encouraged and supported in every way possible to also have a local language that supports the local user communities and other needs, but I think that the other has to be there, yes. And I think that that's the Model 1, as was just stated.
Right. So what do people agree with Model 1, or, you know, what about others?
This is Jeremy. I don't want to draw the discussion to a close, but we're kind of at the top of the hour, and I think that there's a number of points, and maybe the distinction of the models isn't exactly a good place because we're trying to agree on models, and I think that there's nuances of each model that kind of, as we've talked about, the implications, I think, may have shifted our feelings on whether or not some agree that all of Model 1 is accurate, a different model is accurate, and certainly trying to not straddle the technical and policy implications is something that's important that we need to do, and that it probably is coming down to a couple of fundamental questions about things that Jim has been mentioning about. Essentially, is there a character encoding and backwards compatibility? But at the same time, we don't want to do the protocol work necessarily to make those implications, even though they have policy implications.
Right, and thank you, Jeremy. And I don't think that isn't in our remit. I mean, the policy aspect. We make a technical recommendation, and then the policy aspect can flow from there. Since we do need to close up, I'm going to suggest that we as staff try to put down what we think are some areas of agreement, and perhaps point out some areas where there's not agreement. I think that we haven't always had the full group on all of these calls, so I'm really going to try to see if we can get people participating on the list to comment on what we send around. And I think that, you know, there's an important component of using the Brussels meeting to try to get a little more discussion on some of these tricky areas, but I think I feel like we're getting close, so we'll try to see if we can get some information around to help and see if we can move even closer. So anyway, thank you for this very, very helpful discussion. Jeremy, is there anything else you want to add?
Nope.
Great. Anything anybody else wants to add before we adjourn?
Nope. Just thank you, Julie.
Julie, are you going to put together a short description of where we are and float that on the list for us to comment? Is that your next step?
Yes, Steve and I will work together on that. I'll produce some notes from this call, and then based on that, I'll ask Steve to take the first cut, and we'll see if we can come up with something. And of course, we'll ask all of you to comment and maybe point out areas that we don't have quite right. But we'll get that around to the list for everybody to comment on.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, very much. Very helpful discussion, and I hope you all have good mornings, evenings, nights, or wherever. Thanks.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.